Hey, it's Francis. This week we're bringing back a show from last year about the glories of Greek food and wine. Man, do I want to go there. Long Island Sound is pretty, but it's not the same as the Aegean, you know? Anyway, have a listen. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters from APM. When I was in high school, I was like totally obsessed with these food carts called the grease trucks. Right? I mean, first of all, who wouldn't be obsessed with something called the grease trucks? But they were parked in this parking lot on the campus of Rutgers University, the State University of New Jersey. And I remember they were open all night long. They were just these magnificent purveyors of fat. So, you know, kids would come in from their parties or the bar or from studying or whatever at like 2 a.m. and they would be eating these things called fat cats, which are 2 cheeseburgers and french fries stuffed into a bun until there was like this fat arms race. And then the grease trucks, they started, like, one started to add like mozzarella sticks, and another would add like chicken fingers, and then every other fried food you could possibly think of into the sandwich. Anyway, among all of these amazing atrocities was my favorite, a Euro sandwich. I live like 45 minutes away, but the year I got my driver's license, I would drive out in the middle of the night to get gyros from Jimmy at the Sunshine Truck. And, you know, never really questioned why there was this random Greek dish among all the burgers and fries, but it turns out that Jimmy was one in a long, long line in history of Greek diner and greasy spoon and grease truck owners across the country who made a living selling hot dogs and coffee and pancakes, but always kept a Greek specialty or two on offer. And decades later, and by that I mean like last month, I kind of realized that because of that, Greek food is like low-key probably one of the most common immigrant cuisines in the country. And to learn more about that and about Greek food as it exists in Greece, we wanted to talk to Diane Kachilis. She's written 18 books on Greek and Mediterranean food, is the host of My Greek Table on public television, and was the host of the most popular cooking show on TV in Greece. And she joins us from her home in Athens. Diane, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be on the show. I just have to warn you that I'm moving out. Someone's moving in upstairs. My dog's going crazy, so there might be some noise.
This is great. Now, this is home life. We're in permanent home life now, so it's fine. And I want to start. Let me tell you about my childhood. So I grew up in New Jersey, which meant that I kind of grew up in diners. And the thing I would always notice in every diner menu I ever went to, like growing up, there was always a page of the menu that would say Greek specialties.
Okay.
And it was inevitably the same, you know, handful of things, like a gyros, which, you know, I didn't know better, so I would call them gyros all growing up, or, you know, souvlaki, moussaka, you know, really just a small handful of dishes, but they were on every menu. And then, you know, I remember going to a diner in Chicago, and that page was there. And then in like any corner of the country, that page would be there, literally in Birmingham, Alabama, in Florida. And so I was surprised to learn, oh, there is in fact this history of the Greek American community of entrepreneurship in restaurants and diners. And I'm just so curious about how that happened. Obviously, like Chinese restaurants all around the country, and there's a particular history as to how that happened in that community. But do you know the history in the Greek American community?
I know a little bit of it. Greeks are individualists by nature. Mm. You know, we don't have a mass consciousness. We have the consciousness of individuality. And we invented the word ego, right? and atom and, you know, all sorts of other words that have to do with
individual,
know, singular
units.
Things.
Yeah.
And I think part of that story is during the various, you know, big waves of immigration. I think the first Greeks started coming to the States in the early part of the 19th century. A lot of them worked on railroads, worked in the steel mills, worked in that really arduous manual labor. In fact, one of the largest and oldest Greek communities is in Salt Lake City, which I was really surprised to hear. And then there was a huge wave of immigration in the 60s. my experience with restaurant owners and Greek restaurant dynasties in the United States, most of that is centered around the immigration, you know, in the 60s. And you get the crappy work first, right? So you're washing dishes, or you're, you know, maybe you graduate from washing dishes to flipping burgers, or, you know, whatever. And then at some point, you figure out, hey, you know, it's not that hard to do this, and I'd much rather work for myself. And I know, you know, several restaurant dynasties that began that way. One of them is my really good friend in New York, the Livanos Restaurant Group. You know, the dad came to the States from a small village in Lesbos in the 1960s, literally started as a dishwasher in some diner, I think, in Massachusetts, and then, you know, scrimped and saved. And I remember this even as a kid. I mean, a lot of Greeks in the 60s were coming over and living, you know, there'd be like 10 guys living together. And, you know, they would just be saving money and, you know, always with the goal of opening their own business. So the restaurant industry, I think, there's a huge debt of gratitude owed to the Greeks, because not only have Greeks opened Greek restaurants, but, you know, the whole diner culture, even non-Greek restaurants, pizzerias in New England, it's a big Greek, a lot of Greek ownership there. One of the oldest, I think the oldest family-run restaurant in the United States is in the South. That's a Greek-owned family business. The Pappas dynasty in Texas, they own hundreds and hundreds of restaurants. And it's an amazing story, because you know, the grandparents started it, two brothers continued it. You know, it's a very interesting story too, because they do everything in house, like down to the laundry. But I think the essential course was that, you know, you come over, you work in some menial job, then you graduate from that to something a little bit more responsible. And then you know, after scrimping and saving for a few years, you open your first tiny diner or tiny coffee shop, and then you scrimp and save some more, and then you bring your brother into the business and a few cousins, and you all scrimp and save together, and you buy a bigger diner, and then before you know it, you've got, you know, 12 restaurants, and it's the ultimate American dream, you know, success story. I mean, my Livanos is a great example, because, you know, the third generation, most of the kids graduated from Cornell, from the hospitality school. So, you know, it's a really wonderful progression. They stayed in the industry. It's a great industry. And I also think one of the real reasons Greeks have done so incredibly well in the restaurant industry is because we have a really deep sense of hospitality. And without that, you can't succeed in the hospitality industry. We love to serve people our food.
Yeah, that is such a classic story of immigrant communities and how they sort of help each other along, even as they're helping themselves. And then what happens in our country, right? There's a thriving restaurant industry because of these people who built this.
I have this fantasy project, which is to put together a tribute to the Greek-American contribution to the restaurant and hospitality industries, and to curate things like the incredible menu collection at Widener and at Harvard, and also at the New York Public Library, because it's social history. And you see, and yes, as you mentioned earlier, that there was always this corner on the menu of Greek specialties, it's equally interesting to look at Greek church cookbooks, because that's where you really see how the culture integrated. You find recipes like, you know, for spanakopita, the classic spinach and cheese phyllo pie, but you might find it with like Philadelphia cream cheese, because the early Greeks didn't, there was no feta, they couldn't find it. So they had to, you know, it's just a really interesting, it's social history. And to me, it's really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, that's super interesting. And I always love seeing those recipes where like people had to adapt, you know, because they couldn't find their ingredients that, you know, they were used to from where they come from. One of my favorite recipes that I learned to cook last year was by Priya Krishna. Her family is Indian, and they would make sag paneer at home, but they couldn't find paneer in the store, so you made it with feta. So,
oh, really? You know, like,
yeah. But anyway, so like I said, you know, that little corner of the menu in those Greek diners always had the same small handful of dishes, and obviously the Greek cuisine is much wider than gyro sandwiches and souvlaki. So let's go to Greece for a moment with you, you know, because you grew up in the United States, but you spent many years traveling in Greece and living in Greece and, you know, educating us on Greek culture and cuisine, if we could play a little game, and if I could, like, snap my fingers and, like, be standing next to you right now and snap our fingers again, and we could go to any two tables in the country, where would you take me and what should we eat?
That's a hard question to answer. I would probably take you to a Cretan wedding in a small village because we would spend 3 days there.
Okay, and, right on.
But they don't do them so much anymore. That tradition's being lost because people are more affluent, so they go to catering halls. But I would take you to a village wedding so that you could see kind of the elaborate preparation of all sorts of things, from decorative breads to incredible rice dishes cooked in broth that's been simmering, you know, from goat and chicken. Hold on 1 second. My son is calling me. I will, honey. He wants his Greek mother to pick him up from work. And of course, I'm happy to do that. So, yeah. Anyway, you have to give me the opportunity to take you to more than two tables. So one would be...
Okay, three, yeah. Four. You set the number.
One would be my table in Ikaria, because everything comes straight from the garden and it's pretty incredible in the summertime. You know, just to have a tomato that's warm and just cut off the vine and really good olive oil and sea salt that, I try to collect at the end of the summer.
Oh, wow.
Just for that, I think it's worth coming to Greece. And also to introduce you to the incredible wealth of plant-based dishes, which is, you know, a slap in the face to everyone who thinks Greek food is only souvlaki. And then I would probably take you to a great fish taverna, just also to have that experience of really fresh fish, super simply grilled, with nothing but, you know, again, olive oil, sea salt, maybe a little lemon, maybe some fish soup, you know, just really pure flavors based on very, very fresh seasonal ingredients.
Is there a typical style of fish soup?
Probably the most common is the one that you find with avgo lemono, the egg and lemon liaison. But then there are slightly varying Aegean fish soups called kakavia, which is a fisherman's soup. Kakavi is actually the name of the vessel that the fish is simmered in, that the soup is simmered in. And that could have some vegetables in it, maybe some potato, all sorts of different fish. Layered, you know, biggest ones on the bottom, bony fish, if you have scorpion fish or any kind of rock fish, smaller ones on top, slowly simmered, a lot of onion, a lot of olive oil, maybe some tomato, maybe some zucchini, maybe some potato, maybe some carrot, you know, kind of whatever is on hand, maybe a barley rusk, what we call paksimadi.
It's almost like a cracker or like a toast, right? Is that?
Yeah, it's like it's hardtack. It's like it's a rusk. Mm. It's usually pretty thick. It's a very ancient food in Greece. We still use it.
Mm.
So
cool.
Yeah, and then I might take you to my favorite grill taverna, just outside of Athens, where I've taken a good friend of mine who's from northern Italy, and boy, they love their meat in northern Italy. And we sat down, and you know, he saw all the offal, and he saw the innards, and he saw, you know, the sausage that we make called cocorezzi, which is wrapped with intestine and has all sorts of other things, you know, in the inside, on the inside of it, but also amazing lamb chops and pork chops and just all sorts of great grilled meat. And his immediate reaction to that experience was, "Thank you, my darling, I'm in heaven." So I think there are a lot of great tables to be experienced in Greece.
That's Diane Kachilis, host of My Greek Table on public television. And she'll be back in a minute to talk about the glories of Greek regional cooking. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. This week, we're diving into the food and wine of Greece. We've been talking with Diane Kachilis, who knows more about this subject than probably any living American. Let's get back to her. Tell us about that regionality and how different cultures have come to Greece or merged with Greek food, well, and what we see because of that.
Greece, if you think about where it is geographically, it's right between the East and the West. And it's always been a crossroads. It's been conquered. It's conquered. You know, it's Greeks have traveled all over the Mediterranean. They've spread their own food. They've spread wine all over the Mediterranean. So there's always been this fluidity. 100 years ago, in 1922, it was kind of the last throes of the Ottoman Empire, and there was a huge exchange of populations between Greece and Turkey. There was a war. It was one of the, probably the most important historical milestone in the 20th century for Greece outside of World War II and the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And essentially, the million or so Greeks who had been living in Asia Minor for millennia emigrated, many of them back into Greece, and brought with them a much more urban cuisine, because if you were living in a city like Constantinople, Istanbul, or Smyrna, Izmir, or, you know, Ayvali, or other places along the Turkish Asia Minor coast, you were privy to the spice routes, you were privy to a much more cosmopolitan environment, where you were living with, you know, Turks and Armenians and Jews and, you know, kind of everyone from the Eastern Mediterranean. And there was a lot of really interesting food. And so that fact alone changed Greek cuisine 100 years ago. And what had been a very simple peasant cuisine was suddenly changed because of this influx of urban cooks who brought these incredible eggplant dishes with them and spices that, you know, were not really used that much in older Greek cooking. So you
what find are some dishes that show us that? Like, what are some dishes that
moussaka? Moussaka. I mean, that was, you know, that's totally urban dish. That's not a peasant dish. That you have to have a certain skill to make bechamel, which is a French sauce, and, you know, to make this very rich meat sauce. So there are a lot of historical layers in the layers of moussaka. Pastitsio.
Tell us how you make a great moussaka.
Okay, you want a great moussaka, you want great meat. I usually do a combination of lamb and beef. You can hand chop the chopped meat, even better. And you make a very rich sauce that's seasoned with cinnamon and allspice and tomato, of course, and I add a little wine to mine, and sometimes a little sugar or a little bit of beti mezi, which is a grape molasses.
Oh, cool.
You know, there's always, just a pinch, just to balance out the flavor. The eggplant, I used to sauté it, but I have long since abandoned that in favor of a lighter version, which is simply baking the eggplant slices in the oven. And then I do go all out on the bechamel, I make the Greek version of it, which calls for a couple of eggs or egg yolks. I put cheese in it. You know, it's a rich dish.
Sorry, a typical French bechamel would be butter.
I don't know if it has
flour.
Egg.
Yeah, no, it would be typically butter, flour. You make a roux and then you whisk in milk and you just cook it to thicken the milk. Maybe there's onion and whatever.
The Greek version has eggs. Add the egg? Probably because Greek mothers, you know, have to feed their kids eggs. You know how often you take my kids to the park and see some Greek grandmother chasing the grandkid around with a spoon and an egg on it. To me, and then, you know, the layers should be, they should be integrated. I always mix a little bechamel into the sauce, but there should be distinct layers too. So that's my version of a great moussaka. But just to hop back for a second on the whole notion of regional cuisine, you know, other parts of the country, Crete has a very interesting cuisine too, because it's incredibly rich agriculturally. So,
and it's its own island, right?
It's a big island.
Off the main.
Yeah. And there have been many books written just about Cretan cuisine. The Ionian Islands on the western coast of Greece have very, very different cuisine because they were governed by the Venetians for about almost 400 years. They were not really governed by the Ottomans. So you find dishes that are clearly Italian. I was in Friuli, and there's a lot of Venetian influence in the cuisine because it's kind of the same, almost the same area. And there was a dish called saor, which was a sweet and sour fish dish made with fresh anchovies. We do the same thing, especially in the Ionian, called savoro. So it's even almost the same word.
Oh, wow.
So it's really interesting to compare cuisines. There are a lot of foods that unite us across the Mediterranean. But then the other, I think, big division in Greek cooking, you know, it's sort of like the islands versus the mainland. And on the mainland, there was more of a shepherding tradition. So, you know, the most iconic Greek dish, spanakopita, spinach pie, definitely evolved with the shepherds. It was a food that was born out of the need of people who were itinerant and moving and needed food that they could carry and that kept well.
Oh, that's so interesting.
It's fascinating. And there were always greens that they could forage. They always had cheese. They always had some sort of, you know, flour that they could make their own phyllo with. And when they moved from the highlands to the lowlands or vice versa, they always had this, they still do, they had this dome-shaped, usually copper cover that was essentially the cover of a makeshift oven. So they would dig a shallow pit, put their pie pan or their meat or whatever else they were making over this, seal it with dough, and that was their oven. You know, over charcoal or over embers or something. But in the islands, there is a different pie tradition because for the most part, the islands are drier and there's less wood. So people weren't lighting their wood-burning ovens. They had a different way of doing that. So most of the pies on the islands are small handheld pies, like dumplings almost, or like pan-fried, you know, burekia, you know, individual pieces. Or cylinders, you know, sort of like a spring roll look, but usually just pan fried in olive oil. So it was whatever was available. You know, it's interesting to see those differences. In the north, the food is spicier. In Crete, you know, if you served a Cretan, you know, a hot pepper, a chili pepper, they would like jump out of their seat and, you know, probably start a family vendetta. But in the north, you know, you could do that because there was this whole pepper trail up there. So, you know, it's a small country, but even geographically, it's very varied. It's very mountainous.
Yeah.
It's 80% mountains. So up until 20, 30 years ago, when the roads were still really bad, oops, somebody's car alarm just went off. there were these enclaves that remained intact, you know, like most of their history. So it's really fascinating.
Oh, that's amazing. And I love, I mean, like, when we think of regionality in cuisine and we think about the land, what the environment gives you, usually we think about it in terms of ingredients. If you're by the coast, you'll have fish.
Oh, yeah,
the mountains,
absolutely.
Maybe you have sheep. But, I mean, even hearing you talk about how, well, on the islands, there's not a lot of wood because it's not tree-friendly. So the techniques had to change because you couldn't just burn the fires for a super long time and be baking and simmering, you know, like you want to cook stuff fast because you don't have that much fuel. And that's
an element of regionality. There are other historical facts that have also affected sort of the food chain or the type of food. For example, when the Venetians were in Crete and in Corfu, they deforested those islands because they needed the timber for their navy to build their ships. So So it's just really interesting, you know, to connect the dots and think, oh, we're all connected and everything's connected.
Yeah. You mentioned there are so many amazing vegetable dishes in various Greek traditions that we might not know about. So tell us about some of those dishes and what you're excited to cook coming out of your garden right now.
I like to surprise people, especially my Greek friends who are so carnivorous for the most part. Although that's changing a little bit with more environmental awareness. But I like to surprise people with how sating vegetable cooking can be. It used to be that I'd invite Greek friends for dinner and there wouldn't be meat. And there was sort of almost this murmuring like, you know, we're going to have to go out afterwards. You know, there's like, there's no meat on the table. But I mean, it really depends on what part of the summer we're in. But I love zucchini flowers so that when they come up, I'll do all sorts of things with that. I have grape vines, so I'll make dolmades and I'll even put some zucchini, you know, the same stuffing in the zucchini flowers and put that in the same pan.
And so dolmades, the stuffed grape leaves, right? So what's the stuffing you'd use for those flowers?
Usually rice and a lot of herbs and sometimes some nuts, sometimes some raisins, depends on my mood, a lot of onions. That's the secret to all of those stuffed rice dishes because you want that underlying sweetness. So that's, you know, something that I would do, you know, at various points in the summer, or stuffed zucchini, or zucchini on the grill with just a simple lemon vinaigrette, you know, maybe lemon and mastika, which is a Greek spice from the island of Chios. It's a resin, basically. Very interesting flavor that goes very well with citrus. And so if I have big zucchini, I would, you know, almost do like zucchini steaks. Or let's see, all sorts of one pot vegetable dishes. So, you know, braised green beans with tomato and onion and garlic and herbs, or okra, or eggplant, which I make, you know, a million different ways. Just endless. It's endless.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, and it may be hard to think of this because I know you mentioned earlier that it's 100 degrees where you are right now.
It's 100 degrees. It's really hot. Yeah.
And, you know, I think we think of Greece as being one of these, you know, like warm weather almost all year round type places. But what do you cook out of the garden in the winter?
Well, I spend a lot of time at the end of the summer trying to preserve some of that stuff. So sauces and pickled things and, you know, whatever. But in the wintertime, a lot of greens. A lot of those same dishes, but with greens. So I would make, I love the variety of vegetable rice dishes that are particularly popular in the wintertime. So almost like a risotto, but not necessarily with cheese or with butter. It's usually with olive oil. So spinach, like spanakorizo or hortorizo, which is with the same idea with greens. So it's basically just spinach, onion or leek, or onion and leek, or scallion, maybe some shallots or a lot of garlic, cooked for maybe about 45 minutes with rice.
Oh, wow.
So it's very comforting. The same thing with leek, or the same thing with cabbage. With cabbage, I would do, I would add, you know, maybe some spice to that, some cinnamon and maybe some turmeric, or that's not really Greek, but I would definitely add cinnamon and allspice and tomato and raisins and, you know, make it a little bit more substantial. Or I would do stuffed cabbage or stuffed, you know, pickled vine leaves. Or, I mean, for every day, my everyday cooking, a lot of pulses, lentil soups, you know, all sorts of ways. Greek giant beans, braised and, you know, baked with all sorts of different seasonings. I'll do pies, a lot of savory pies too in the wintertime with all sorts of greens. And a lot of times these pies, you know, they have 20 different things in them. So you have spinach and chard and sorrel and maybe some sweet dandelion and chervil and wild fennel and parsley and dill and mint and, you know, leek and onion and scallion and, you know, it just goes on and on. A carrot or pumpkin, a lot of things with winter squashes too. I make a soufiko, which is the Icarian kind of national dish from Icaria, which has a winter and a summer version.
Oh, cool. What is it?
In the summertime, it's layers of egg, of zucchini, eggplant, potato, all thinly sliced, tomato, garlic, oregano, a lot of onion. Usually just quickly cooked in the oven in thin slices, but then layered and simmered all together or baked all together into this beautifully rich and herbal casserole. And in the wintertime, I would do the same thing, except I would replace the zucchini with winter squash, chestnuts in certain dishes, stewed leeks. I mean, and these are all, the interesting thing is that in traditional Greek cooking, those are main courses. It's not, they're not side dishes.
Yeah.
You know, that's dinner. You know, if I cook a lentil soup, that's dinner. If I cook a spinach rice dish, that's dinner.
Yeah. Can you walk us through the technique of how you make one of these spinach or greens rices? Because
Yeah, that's really easy.
Just walk us through.
I typically use fresh spinach. You know, I usually try to buy organic. So I trim it. You know, you saute, you know, two or three large red onions. You cook them until they're very soft. You wilt them. I add the spinach to that. And I eyeball it. So I couldn't tell you the proportion or the, you know, I add about a cup of rice. And it's usually a rice called Carolina, which is very similar to risotto rice. And so I would add, you know, onion, garlic, then spinach, cook the spinach down until it loses some volume, then add, I would do it either one of two ways, either that way and add my rice to that, or add the rice to the onion so that you get sort of like a nuttiness.
Sort of toasty.
Out of the rice and then add the spinach and let the spinach exude its own liquid and then kind of figure out how much additional water or broth or wine or combination of those three you need, and then you just basically cook it really slowly. Then you finish it with olive oil and lemon juice, and you serve that typically with feta cheese on the side. And if you want it, if you have a hungry 20-year-old, maybe with a couple of fried eggs.
Yum. And just so I have a sense of the finish, is it meant to be soupy in the end? Is the rice firmly cooked?
The rice is soft. It's not the consistency of risotto. It's not toothsome. It's really soft and comforting. And I mean, I cook that for about an hour. So it's really
almost
well cooked.
Halfway to porridge.
Yeah. It's thicker than porridge. You eat it with a fork, not a spoon.
Okay. But I love that. Like, 'cause that does sound so just warming, you know, and just such a grounding dish. And then like with some nice salty feta on the side. That sounds super yummy.
It's really delicious and comforting and easy. And I often add some dill to that or parsley. There's a more of an herbal palate in Greek cooking than a spice palate. That's not to say, of course, we don't use spices, but it's more herbal. And I think that's just a reflection of the incredibly rich flora in this country.
Yeah. Like everything that you said, it's all about the land and and what it gives you.
Yeah, that's cool. Essentially it.
Diane, this has been great. And once it's not 100 degrees for you and 88 degrees for me, I will probably be stewing some greens with rice. And I can't wait for the weather to change to get back to that.
Thank you. Thank you. It was fun to be on the show. And thank you for inviting me.
Diane Kachilis is host of My Greek Table on Public Television and author of the book of the same name. You'll find a collection of Greek-inspired recipes at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the delicious and underappreciated wines of Greece with Tara Q. Thomas of Wine and Spirits magazine. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. This week, we're all about the flavors of Greece, and you have to figure that the people who invented the word amphora are into wine. And honestly, I don't know anyone who's more into Greek wine than my dear friend Tara Q. Thomas, who actually lived and cooked there for a while. She's editor-at-large of Wine and Spirits magazine, is the author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Wine Basics, and here she is, talking with our own Sally Swift.
So we have brought you in. We're doing a whole show on Greek food today, and of course there's no way we could do it without talking about Greek wine. And I have to admit that I live with a wine writer, so I get to taste stuff all the time that most people don't. But I have fallen hard for Greek wine. I think they're amazing. They taste like what those islands look like to me. Is that even possible?
Oh, completely, completely. I think it's as if the grapes just soak up all of the sun and all of that lovely, salty sea air and turn it into their personality.
Yeah, they are really something. So what do we need to know about Greek wine in general? I know, that's a big
that
question.
There, yes, that really, there's so much diversity in it. I mean, the islands have a tremendous amount of wine. And when you think about Greek wine, you often think of those hot, sun-drenched islands and very beachy wines, but there's so much more to it. Every island has its own personality, but then you also have the whole entire mainland. And when you go all the way up to the north, you know, it's cold, it snows, and you get red wines that could evoke places like Piedmont, you know, like northern Italy. There is every sort of wine available
there. It's so interesting you say that, because that's exactly what I think of when I drink that red wine. So can you walk us through just a couple of things that you think we should check out? And can we start with that red wine? What's the grape, and what do we need to know about that?
So the red wine that I'm thinking of is actually, the region is called Nausa. It's west of Thessaloniki. So we're talking way far in the northwest of Greece. And it comes from one particular grape called Xenomavro, which means basically sour black, which sounds terrible. However, it really just means that it's got a lot of acidity and it's got a lot of tannin, which means it's got great possibility for structured wines that live a long time. And this region, just to give you a visual, it's very foresty, it's very cool, it's very damp, it gets foggy in the autumn, and very much, in fact, like Piedmont. And the wines are often compared to Barolo because they do take on this earthy, truffly note along with all their nice cherry fruit. And they have such good structure that they can age really well for 10, 20 years, no problem at all.
So in that region, what are you eating? Because these wines are really food wines, I would say.
Lamb.
Absolutely lamb.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you're a good 2 hours from the ocean. So you're talking mountain-raised lamb, you know, foraging on all the herbs that grow wild in the hills, and then cooked over vine leaves on an open fire. It's just perfect.
And do you have any particular bottles we should try, or what should we look for?
Well, Butari makes the sort of standard bearer for Nausa in their Grand Reserve Nausa. But there's another producer called Kiryani, which is actually owned by the brother of the man who runs Butari. They used to run it together, and then they split up. And so Kiryani would be another terrific producer. And then there's another that I really like from a winery called Argatia. And it's one of the few wineries run by a woman in Greece.
Yay. Go, girl. That's wonderful. Okay, so let's move on and talk about some whites. Where do you want to start with that?
I think if you think about white wines for Greece, the place your mind goes first is Santorini, which does make arguably the best white wines in all of Greece. However, the secret is out and the prices have gone so sky high. Land prices are very expensive. It's Napa level prices.
Wow.
But the good side is that their success has inspired growers all over Greece to plant a Syrtiko, which is the grape that Santorini is made from. So finally, now, you can find good versions of a Syrtiko from the mainland.
I love that grape. When I said at the top of the interview that these wines taste like what it looks like, that grape to me has so much salt in it, and you can kind of taste the wind, and you taste the rock of the islands. Am I making this all up?
Not at all. It can almost have this like searingly bright flavor, just like the when you see a picture of Santorini and how bleached out all of the buildings and the volcanic land looks. They absolutely have that. You don't get that quite as much in mainland Assyrtiko.
And do you have a couple that you think we should try? And what would you pair with them, food-wise?
Well, you can really find good mainland Assyrtiko all over. However, I would go to the north where it's cool. And so you have a higher chance of getting ones that are almost as crisp and salty as the Santorini ones. So if you look for estates like Alpha Estate or Nerantzi or Voyatsi, all of these producers make really good, crisp, clean, savory assyrtiko.
Okay, so let's move on to retsina, which is that kind of iconic Greek wine. It's made with pine resin. There's that aroma of conifer in it. I think a lot of people know it from their Greek restaurant experiences 30 years ago. You sent me a couple of bottles that just really blew my mind. It's a beautiful, beautiful wine.
Retsina has come so far. So pine resin used to be a way of hiding faults in bad wine, right? And then the quality winemakers who started coming out in the 90s and 2000s and really working hard to improve the Greek wine scene didn't want to have anything to do with retsina. But as Yanni Periskevopoulos, a winemaker friend of mine, said to me once, if 10 million people love retsina, mm-hmm. then they can't all be wrong. Mm-hmm. And so he started researching retsina and trying to find out, you know, what could I do to make really good retsina? And by looking way back at some ancient texts, he found that, first of all, they didn't use tons of pine resin, but also there were particular forests that stood out for the quality of their pine resin. And so he's actually searched out his own little forest of Aleppo pine trees, and he developed a retsina made from very good quality wine. It's actually made from very high altitude grapes, so he gets a nice, crisp, bright white wine. Mm. And then he uses this Aleppo pine resin, just a little bit of it, to create a retsina that he calls Retinitis Nobilis. And I think the effect is unbelievable. It's like electric in its freshness. And the pine flavor doesn't hit you over the head. Mm-hmm. It comes through more of like the fragrance of sea air filtered mm-hmm. through pine trees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do Greeks eat with retsina?
Well, this is the wonderful thing about retsina. It goes with everything.
Yeah.
Even if there's not that much resin flavor, it still gives it this character that can cut through all sorts of really garlicky food, really oily food, rich. And it can be delicate at the same time. Mm-hmm. So if you think of the typical Greek meze spread, you know, when you have the garlicky tzatziki and all the different vegetable dips and the lamb and the fish and the shrimp and, you know, everything all together, retsina can do it.
Do you have a couple you love?
I love the Yea Retinitis Nobilis. And Kekris is terrific if you can find it. They are really retsina magicians. They make even a red retsina. They make oaked versions of retsina. They're like mad scientists with it. But also Papayanakos, which is impossible to pronounce. But
you do pretty well.
And Milonas as well makes a really nice, less aggressive, rounder, generous retsina.
Tara, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Tara Q. Thomas is hard at work on the forthcoming new edition of the Oxford Companion to Wine. You can find her picks of Greek wines to try at splendidtable.org. The sisters Despina Kouris and Stephanie Dimitriadis are Greek-American. And honestly, like so many of us children of immigrant families, they could have let their culture kind of melt away. But they didn't. They celebrate Greek traditions and speak the language, and they learned those things from their grandparents who came to America in their 20s. For our family kitchen series, Intimate Conversations in People's Kitchens, we join the sisters at their grandmother's house in Queens, New York, while making one of their favorite dishes, stuffed cabbage leaves called sarmatas.
My name is Despina Kouris. I am from New York, born and raised, and I am now living in a suburb in Massachusetts with my husband and two kids. One of my fondest memories from visiting my grandparents would have to be our sleepovers. We'd have sleepovers there often, my sister and my brother wasn't born yet. So we would sleep there quite a bit, and I mean, everything just tasted better at my grandmother's house. Having real authentic Greek food in the evening, a little snack at night, which we never got at the house, and then really early morning wake-ups with my grandmother cooking and my grandfather opening all the doors and singing really loud Greek hymns just to get us all up. They were the ones that we spoke to in Greek. We made Greek dishes with them. All the Greek traditions that we know come from them. So like our strongest connection is definitely with my grandmother and my grandfather from my mom's side. So a couple of weeks ago, we went to visit my grandparents. And I think if we're being honest, she is most comfortable in the kitchen with stories because my grandfather's not around, so he can't hear her reminisce on things that might make him reminisce and get uncomfortable or feel emotions that she doesn't want him to have to relive. They're some of my favorite times with her because that's when she's her most authentic self. And I was really looking forward to it because it's been a while since I was able to actually cook in the kitchen with her, and especially have my sister there too. I mean, I don't remember the last time the three of us were in the kitchen together. So it was a good time. And she made one of my favorite dishes, sarmadas, which is basically meat, rice, and spices wrapped in cabbage leaves. I do get nervous to perform in front of my grandmother, perform in the sense of cooking. I do get nervous even now. And so when I go in there and I'm just like, okay, let me try and fold this sarmada the way you want me to fold it correctly, it is a little intimidating. But she, because we have a good relationship, I don't ever get offended by her roughness around the kitchen. She wants me to be really good at this because this is the legacy that she's going to leave us. This is what she's going to be able to pass down. More than any physical things, I know that she would want to be remembered for how she made us feel and how well she kept our bellies full. She has actually said to me and my sister on many occasions, like, I hope that when you make this and I'm not here anymore, that you'll remember me, like, as you're making it.
Okay, now let's go make some stuffed cabbage, okay.
Stuffed cabbage, yes.
Yaya, do you remember the first time you made this?
I will never remember first time. I was so young, and a lot of things I learned from my grandmother. She used to make baklava, she used to make sarali, she used
what
to make...
What is
sarali? Another with the walnuts.
Oh, I don't think we've made that.
And she used to say, get out of here. She make a little, like a table for me. And,
so she wanted you out of her space. She yeah. wanted to make like one table yes. for you, one table for her.
Okay. So I used to play around.
That's so funny.
So that way I learned a lot of stuff, believe me, a lot.
So I'm excited because I've never made this before and it's one of my favorites. Actually, so there are like two different ways to make a very similar recipe. One of them is... like this one, which is my favorite, and also the only one I can eat, because the other one is with grape leaves, and I'm allergic to grapes. So every time Yaya says she's making this, I get excited, because I know she's making it with the cabbage and not with the grape leaves, because I can eat it. The Greek people do either...
That's the clock from the Bulova, where yeah. she used to work. Well, is it from... Yeah,
it is.
It's not Bulova. The original, but it's the replacement.
Yeah. So we continued wrapping the cabbage leaves, and when we finished them, we kind of stepped back so Yaya could look them over and let us know how we did. And she definitely had some thoughts.
Stephanie, I can tell one by one all you stuff in things. What is this?
Let me
she
redo them.
Oh, Lord.
I want
the
you to
like,
learn
I'm
good.
I'm stuffing it as tight as I can.
You're holding it wrong, that's why.
Stephanie, come on. This is why okay, we're learning look. With Yaya, so we do it right. So we can yell at our own grandkids.
No.
Now, I take from here, then, and I fold and it tightly, and then on the sides, and I work the way down to the palm of my hand.
Keep
going in. What? I'm going to spread it out. You
no,
give me a
it's
chance.
Like that. You have to see this inside out. It's very important.
Okay. Does it explode
well, then I did this
when it's
one wrong?
Yeah, of course you did it wrong.
Okay, all right.
End of this episode, everyone's going to know why I don't cook with Yaya in the kitchen.
Why, Moro?
Because Yaya...
I'm not yelling you. I want you to learn correct.
Talks. I know. Were you always good at this? Or did you? Were you always good at this, or did your mom or Yaya correct you all the
Nobody
time?
Nobody correct me. My mother used to say, you do it better, you do it.
Okay, well, then I guess we're learning from the expert.
Okay, I'm not doing it tight enough. That's the problem.
Okay.
Do you hear that? The kid's graduating outside. I couldn't find parking.
So you guys gonna graduate after this cookie?
That's true. I am gonna graduate after this cooking. Oh, yeah, that's great.
That's Despina Koris and Stephanie Dimitriadis with their grandmother, Despina Delianides. And hey, we want to hear your family kitchen stories. What's lovely and even what's not, because it's all about real life. If you have ideas, send them to us at contact@splendidtable.org. And that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed it, and we hope you're psyched to go eat or cook or drink some Greek wine and food. We'll talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table is created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetta Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lugge, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.